there, Super Conscious Success fam. Welcome back to another chapter reading where we are going to be putting everything into practice from Buddhism for Mothers. So the chapter is actually entitled Putting It Into Practice, and it is the final chapter of this book. I hope that you have really enjoyed it. I hope that as a parent, whether you're a mother or a father, that you've gotten a lot out of it, a lot about how to incorporate mindfulness into your day, a lot about how to consciously parent your children, and so much more. So I'm looking forward to this chapter where we can start to wrap it all up and actually start to put it into practice. That's going to be lots of fun. So let's get started. Holding the baby, I stop stirring the pot to answer the phone. Straining to hear over the general commotion of dinner time, I was able to catch her words. Oliver has been complaining that he doesn't want to see Zach anymore because Zach keeps hurting him and he doesn't want to go to Zach's party. That's why we haven't been seeing you so much lately. Oliver just doesn't want to go near Zach because he's afraid of getting hurt. I haven't actually seen Zach hurting him, but it wouldn't be like Oliver to make it up, and he has commented two or three times now. Oliver isn't physical like that at all, and he doesn't like it. I thought it best to tell you. Oliver was Zach's favourite friend in the world. I thought back to Oliver's fourth birthday party this week before and remembered how Oliver seemed to be ignoring Zach, walking away whenever Zach came near him. In a state of shock and confusion, I replied, "Well, thanks so much for letting me know. It can't have been easy for you to tell me. You're very brave and I'm glad you didn't just sit on the information. I don't know what to say. I've never seen Zach hurt him either." Feeling satisfied with what I felt had been a calm, measured response, I hung up the phone and proceeded to go to pieces, announcing to my husband, "We've got a crisis on our hands." Was my son secretly violent and sadistic, as our four-year-old informer was suggesting? I knew that if struck, Zach would strike back. I knew he was physical and at times rough, but I'd rarely seen him attack anybody unprovoked. I found myself growing angry with Oliver. He'd obviously turned against Zach and wanted to make him suffer. Then I was angry with his mother. How could she accept the word of a four-year-old who was certainly no angel himself? Besides, all the boys at Oliver's party seemed to be rough, ramming into each other on the jumping castle. Then again, maybe she and her son were completely justified. I felt confused. The next day, I rang Zach's preschool teacher, who told me that Zach was as rough as any of the boys his age, and that although she'd seen him lose his temper and strike out, he was definitely one of the milder ones. We had to concede that at home, Zach had recently become more short-tempered, but we'd put it down to the arrival of testosterone. I decided it was best to tell Zach the bad news. Maybe he needed to learn something. Besides, he kept asking to see Oliver. Zach denied he'd ever hit Oliver, then claimed Oliver had hit him first, then he had a little cry. I was no closer to knowing the truth, but was glad the sad news didn't seem to do any deep psychological damage to Zach. For the best part of 24 hours, I felt quite depressed about the phone call. Sitting in front of the nightly news, I listened to stories of Afghani refugees arriving back home after 2 years in leaky boats and detention centres, and there I was anguished by a tiff between 2 4-year-olds. I had satisfied myself that Zach did not have any more than a mild problem with aggression that, if monitored, would disappear. So why did I overreact like that? Why did I cling to a negative mind state that made me feel unhappy? It came down to the second noble truth of Buddhism, desire, or in this case its flip side, aversion, causes suffering. Applying Buddhism to a mother's quandary. I stubbornly wanted the world to be other than it was. I wanted my son to behave like a pacifist. I wanted him to have a best friend, devoted and loyal. Watching Oliver and Zach play together had always warmed my heart. What was hurting me most, though, was my desire for Zach to never experience rejection. Examining my thoughts with mindfulness, I could see that this episode had teased out my own pain from times past when friends had suddenly taken an unexplained dislike to me, leaving me frustrated and hurt. I never wanted Zach to experience this part of life, especially not at the tender age of 4, and this incident was forcing me to face this fear. The irony was that while I was busy sulking, Zach was getting on with life, playing kangaroos with the children next door. So how did practicing Buddhism help me through this? 10 years ago, I'm sure I would have acted defensively on the phone, attacking the other mother with accusations about how her son was treating mine. But Buddhism has brought me to admit that every time I've ever responded angrily, I've done harm, not least to myself. Buddhism helps me to resist the pull of automatic reactions such as denial, blaming and defensiveness, and take a deeper look at what's going on. The challenge was to see these events with clarity rather than defend my ground. My practice allowed me to watch the inner journey of this mind drama so that I could identify all the thoughts, beliefs and emotions fueling my unhappiness. It was an opportunity for spiritual practice, showing me what I cling to and requiring me to let go and make room for patient acceptance of anything I couldn't fix. Buddhism has also taught me not to jump to conclusions and cling to my views. Rather than denying Zach's potential for aggression, as I'd like to, I have to keep my mind open to all possibilities and monitor his behaviour through this phase. Rather than demonise Oliver's family, I say I don't know and surrender to the ever-unfolding mystery of it all. Then again, some would say I think too much, and they're dead right. What I really needed was time out on my meditation cushion, and over the weekend that followed, I managed to find 40 minutes for uninterrupted meditation. Starting with mindfulness of the breath meditation, I managed to bask in some stillness, some spaciousness. Inspired by some recent teachings, I then worked on my determination to be happier, slowly repeating, "I will transform my mind," as a way to stop surrendering to negative mind states. After this sitting, not only did I feel calm and revitalized, but the whole episode suddenly became a vague memory and I wondered why I had ever made such a fuss. As my wise mother-in-law said with a shrug, "Sazami ziki si kluka zarizi," which is Polish for "kids fight, it happens." Although my wounds can at times reopen when my son asks to see his friend, I feel that my practice helps me to deal with the issue like a grown-up. So what is Buddhism again? Perhaps in response to the vastness and complexity of modern Buddhism, with its 2,500 years of history in a variety of cultures, there have been several attempts to summarize it, to reduce it to one catchy message. Some describe Buddhism simply as mindfulness or awakening to the present moment. In the words of 15th century Zen master Ikuu, "Attention, attention, attention." Another summary of Buddhism offered earlier in this book refers to our potential to substitute our usual thoughts and actions with more wholesome alternatives, stopping and realizing. Some describe Buddhism as the cultivation of wisdom and compassion. This summary is usually accompanied by the observation that there can be no wisdom without compassion and no compassion without wisdom. In Buddhism, our access to that which is divine is through the heart. Buddhism is about love. The Dalai Lama often says, "My religion is kindness." Others would describe Buddhism as the Four Noble Truths together with the Noble Eightfold Path, or as the Buddha concisely puts it, "I teach suffering and the end of suffering." The Eightfold Path requires us not to limit our practice to a meditation session, nicely compartmentalized from the rest of our lives, but to extend our awareness to every aspect of our lives so that we live every moment as mindfully, compassionately, and ethically as possible. A more concise way of summarizing this idea comes in my own favorite summary of Buddhism: learn to do good, cease to do harm, and purify the mind. Many Buddhists commit this one to memory and use it as a mantra throughout the day or for a meditation session. It's a soothing summary to come back to when you feel yourself becoming overstimulated by the impressive array of teachings. What I particularly like about Buddhism. With its long history and wide range of cultural settings, it's unsafe to generalize about the way people practice Buddhism, for there will be an exception to anything you say. Still, I'd like to make some generalizations based on my own experience, although I'm sure there are those who would debate them. Buddhism treats you like an adult. It's not a religion. You don't need to believe anything unless it fits within your own personal experience. You use your own judgment inspired by wisdom and compassion, rather than follow a set of sacred thou shalts. Spiritual progress is your responsibility. You set the pace. In Buddhism, there is no God, no creator, no judge to set rules, watch you, and assess your behavior. For many, it comes as a relief to hear that Buddhists work not so much against sin as delusion. And you deal with delusion not through guilt and suppression, but awareness and insight. The Buddha did not seek blind faith from his followers, but the opposite, a questioning approach. In the Buddha's words, "Do not accept anything because 1. Of repeated oral transmission, 2. Of lineage or tradition, 3. It has been widely stated, 4. It has been written in books such as scriptures, 5. It is logical and reasonable, 6. Of inferring and drawing conclusions, 7. It has been thought out, 8. Of acceptance and conviction through a theory, 9. The speaker appears competent, or 10. Of respect for the teacher. Know what things would be censured by the wise and which, if pursued, would lead to harm and suffering." Encouraged to question, his followers develop their own wisdom. The emphasis is on inquiry, trying teachings out for yourself and putting them through the test of your own personal experience. The Buddha didn't expect us to blindly embrace all Buddhist teachings. Personally, I can't quite accept the concept of reincarnation, even though other Buddhists I know find it obvious or perfectly logical. It's not that I can present any compelling evidence against it, but when it comes to death, my overriding feeling is that I just don't know. I'm grateful my reservations about this belief will never see me excluded from Buddhist circles. The Buddha hardly sounds like the leader of a religion. For example, in this quotation, I'm not teaching you to have you as my pupil. I'm not interested to make you my pupil. I'm not interested in breaking you from your old teacher. I'm not interested even to change your goal because everyone wants to come out of sufferings. Try something that I've discovered and then judge it for yourself. If it is good for you, accept it. Otherwise, don't accept it. Humans being humans, there are Buddhists who have squeezed their Buddhism into a more religious shape. As with all systems, some have found ways to make Buddhism political, sexist, or obscured by rituals. Buddhism has been practiced in so many countries for so many years that it has collected some exotic bells and whistles, but they are always secondary to the main teachings, and you can ignore them if they don't support your practice. Buddhists don't need to produce converts. There's no need to save people, offer your firstborn, or argue your partner into submission. My own husband, a committed atheist, has not the slightest interest in Buddhism and probably never will. Yet our different standpoints have never been a source of conflict, rather of lively, stimulating discussion. In making me calmer and happier, Buddhism has in fact done more to nurture our partnership than polarize us. A religion can provide comforting answers to all those meaning of life questions. In Buddhism, you find guidelines on how to discover your own answers and perhaps more importantly, your questions. For life is seen as a series of mysteries. Buddhism encourages us to be open to every new experience without automatically applying all our prejudices and tired opinions. As the eminent Zen master Shunryu Suzuki said, in the beginner's mind there are many possibilities, but in the expert's there are a few. The need to slow down. When we are too plain busy, we have no time to absorb the present moment, notice our surroundings, or meditate. Nor do we have space to reflect on our lives, analyze where we're going, and whether we even want to go there. Busyness undermines our capacity for acts of love by robbing us of time to listen to others, notice how they're feeling, and then help them. To quote the Buddha, "The restless, busy nature of the world, this, I declare, is at the root of pain. Attain that composure of mind which is resting in the peace of immortality. Self is but a heap of composite qualities, and its world is empty like a fantasy." Those of us who juggle career and kids know that when we're stressed over our workload, spending time with our children can be exasperating. It's so trying to spend time at a park when there's important work to do. When you become too obsessed with productivity, it's hard to adapt to the children's pace, to be present and accepting of the present moment. Sometimes we have little choice but to be busy. Family life seems to require this of us. But at other stages in our lives, we need to ask, could we be burying ourselves in activity to avoid facing the big questions? Do we find it so difficult to cope with unstructured time that we set our lives up to avoid it? If this is the case, what is the price of our addiction to busyness? For many, the price is a feeling of disconnection from those around them and from any chance of fostering the kind of families and communities that humans so profoundly need. Or the price could be disconnection from ourselves, addiction to stress, or a failure to find joy in life. We need to create some space in our lives if we want to progress along a spiritual path. Before children, when life became too troubling, we might have thrown ourselves into our work, started new hobbies, or lost ourselves in a social world, anything to distract ourselves from facing time alone with our thoughts. Now we are parents and in danger of neglecting our children if we chase these time-consuming distractions. We need to find ways to live in harmony with ourselves and our families. Creating time. What would it take to create some time for spiritual pursuits such as meditation, spiritual study, enjoying nature, or being fully present to listen to someone? Reducing the hours we spend in front of TV, resisting the impulse to turn on the radio, spending less time in idle chatter. It's not uncommon as people advance along a spiritual path to make major lifestyle changes to create more time. People throw in their unsatisfying jobs, move away from their expensive neighborhood, sell cumbersome assets and destructive relationships, scale down their social lives, or spend less money. To what extent could we all simplify our lives? Tidy up, give stuff away, reduce the time we spend consuming the news, so much of which we forget? Does the way we entertain ourselves keep our life pacey, or does it help you to slow down and develop inner peace? Several times the Buddha advised us to be moderate in eating. We can eat plainer foods instead of food that saps our energy, get enough sleep and exercise. The Buddha urged us to look after our health as a way to ensure we have the energy for spiritual development. To keep the body in good health is a duty, for otherwise we shall not be able to trim the lamp of wisdom and keep our mind strong and clear. It helps if we regularly ask ourselves, how would I spend this day, week, or month if I knew it was my last? In other words, what really matters and what is mere bustle? If we can learn what we need to be happy, we can stop wasting energy on our delusions. It also helps to recognize that what we really want from life is not so much the external objects or experiences, but the positive mind states that we associate with them. Wouldn't it be wiser to seek that mind state from inner work instead of chasing the externals? It reminds me of that joke, if half the fun of a holiday is planning it, then just stay home and plan too. If we manage to rearrange our lives a little, remove some of the clutter, what might this new space bring us? We could enjoy time for silence, stillness, and meditation. We might watch our children sleeping, gaze into the eyes of our baby, go for a walk, observe nature, write in a diary, enjoy a slow meal, or listen to all the sounds around us. We might do something utterly spontaneous, pick some flowers, chat to a stranger, go for a leisurely wander to explore a neighborhood. These activities allow us to reconnect with ourselves and find energy. They also remind us that life can be lighter, more spontaneous, and enjoyable. Finding a spiritual community. From time to time, we might catch a glimpse of a better way to live, of the greater person we could become, or perhaps of what we are doing wrong. Moments of lucidity. They might come from reading a book, finding some time for reflection, or meeting someone who inspires us. The important question is, how can we make these moments of inspiration actually amount to something? How can we change our lives in a lasting way? If we read the occasional book about Buddhism, we are left with a practice that comes and goes and does little for us at any deep level. We end up using Buddhism as one more way to make us feel good, something to revisit every 6 months or every few years. For those interested in committing to spiritual progress, the answer is to join a spiritual community. When we receive regular teachings from a qualified teacher and meet with others who are trying to apply these teachings, motivation can cease to be an issue. The three treasures the Buddha said could sustain us on our spiritual path are the Buddha, who inspires us to awaken, the Dharma, his teachings, and the Sangha, the spiritual community. An author who has studied with Tibetan lamas for over 20 years, Julie Henderson, gives this interesting explanation for why we need a Sangha. We are extraordinarily influenced by primate and tribal needs. What this means practically is that we want very much to fit in with those around us. We are far more likely to take on the states of being of the folks around us than we are to create cleaner states on our own. Even when the states of the people around us are miserable and unpleasant, it is simply easier to participate in them as they are than to make our own separate from theirs. Notice this has led to an understanding of Sangha as that group of people who actively and consciously pursue embodiment of the four primary states and in so doing, make it easier for all to do so. It takes strength to resist the messages our materialistic society bombards us with, and the people around us might not question such messages. Often enough, we live with people who think they can find happiness from cars, money, property, beauty, and youth, and it's easy to absorb such values ourselves. How refreshing it is to immerse ourselves in a culture where the values are deeper than this, values such as loving kindness, compassion, sympathetic joy, and equanimity. Choosing a tradition. On my weekly night off from family duties, I used to enjoy touring around my city looking at the different Buddhist schools on offer. One night I'd be chanting in Tibetan, another night walking slowly around a candlelit room with 50 people in walking meditation. At one centre I'd be on a journey with creative visualizations, and at the next one I'd be sending out loving kindness to all living beings. Meeting the different teachers and practitioners was as stimulating as it was fascinating. To start on our spiritual path seriously, however, we need to commit to one teacher from one school of Buddhism, otherwise we skim about the surface of several practices rather than going deeply into one. In Buddhism, lineage is the key word when it comes to choosing a teacher. A qualified teacher comes from a long line of teacher-student relationships stretching back to the Buddha himself. Within each lineage, there are likely to be courses of study or other programs which we can follow to a level of suit ourselves. We can take it as seriously as we need to, choosing a path to full ordination or just dropping in occasionally to hear some teachings. Our choice of a school are likely to be Zen, Tibetan, or Theravadan. In essence, the core message is the same in all Buddhist schools, the difference usually lying more in the approach to practice. It might even be wiser to choose a Sangha based on our rapport with the teacher rather than on the school of Buddhism. Realistically, for mothers, the choice may come down to convenience as we settle on the closest school or the easiest time slot. We can make some generalizations about the differences between the schools, but since Buddhism tends to adapt to the culture it settles in, generalizations can only be rough. A Western orientation to any of these schools is likely to downplay rules, rituals, and customs. Without exploring the schools within each of these schools, we can tentatively make the following generalizations. Tibetan. Buddhism probably provides the most exotic extras in the way of chanting and statues and rituals, possibly due to the Tibetans' attempts to salvage their threatened culture. Most of the recently established Western Buddhist centers in Australia are Tibetan. With its emphasis on kindness, the Tibetan school is the most altruistic of the traditions, all efforts to attain enlightenment being with a view to helping all living beings. Interestingly, Tibetan Buddhism differs from the other schools in its appreciation for the scriptures, for learning, memorizing, debating, and using the intellect. It also makes greater use of creative visualization or imagery in meditation. Theravadan. Buddhism is practiced in Sri Lanka, Thailand, Laos, Cambodia, and Burma, and is often seen as the simplest of the traditions with the least ritual. It emphasizes the importance of achieving insight during meditation by mindfully observing distractions rather than forcing them out of our consciousness. The Theravadan school is seen as a purer form of Buddhism because it uses the oldest and most original of the Buddhist scriptures. Zen Buddhism, practiced mainly in China, Korea, and Japan, could be described as the most rigorous school, emphasizing hard work and struggle in meditation. The popular Vietnamese monk Thich Nhat Hanh, on the other hand, heads a school of Zen Buddhism, which some find gentle and relatively easy for a Westerner to slip into. Traditional Zen is also quite anti-intellectual, seeing books, discussions, thinking, and teaching as distractions to true practice. Although compassion is an important part of Zen, the main emphasis is on developing one's ability to be present for the here and now. Rinzai Zen Buddhism is well known for using koans, which meditators must spend hours, weeks, or months solving. The most famous example must be, what is the sound of one hand clapping? The purpose of koans is to prove the limitations of the rational mind and the need to transcend it in order to gain insight. The path of a practicing parent. The 14th century Indian sage Shantideva poses the question, given all the thistles, thorns, and rocks, why cover the whole world with leather when you could use a pair of sandals? In the same way, why try to change the world when we could just change the mind? But it takes us a long time to learn the futility of forcing life to be other than it is. We don't easily give up our unrealistic hopes of arranging our lives to avoid suffering and the unsatisfactory. We have years of conditioning to overcome and some well-entrenched delusions to root out. We may need to practice mindfulness for years before we even become aware of some of our delusions. We need to remind ourselves regularly that the world outside us fails to deliver lasting, reliable happiness, that we need to strive for inner peace. Buddhism teaches us that romance, wealth, achievement, and relationships all cause us misery if we grasp at them with desirous attachment. To be happy, we need to transform our minds. Parents have a head start when it comes to giving up on the external world to deliver happiness. Our children won't let us participate in it to anywhere near the extent we'd like to. They force us to stop chasing external happiness and to instead spend rainy days in our living rooms, sunny days at playgrounds, cloudy days pacing shopping malls. By removing so many of the distractions from our lives, they require us to turn inward for happiness. And so often they hold up a mirror for us to see what our minds are really like. Sometimes it's not a pretty sight and we realize what we need to work on. Yes, children are the most demanding and merciless of spiritual teachers. Again and again, our children turn us into amateurs. As they move from phase to phase, our ability to cope with what's going on will vary from month to month, along with our ability and commitment to practice Buddhist teachings. But if we can develop some inner peace, some equanimity, what is happening outside us has less potential to overexcite or upset us. Within a peace, we create some space between external events and our response to them. And this can only make us more helpful to our children as we parent them attentively and provide better role models. On starting to put Buddhist teachings into practice, you might find many aspects of your life improve dramatically. Some changes are easy to implement. It doesn't stretch us too far to be a little friendlier to people in our community, more loving to our family members, and more positive in our outlook. Within a very short time, we might be impressed by how Buddhist practice has improved our life. But we must be ready for the plateau. Many aspects of our life only show progress after years of practice. We might need many years to rid our minds of harmful thoughts, forgive those who have wounded us, and conquer negative mind states. Nobody finds a journey along a spiritual path a straight line of progress. Life still has its highs and lows, and with them our commitment travels through peaks and troughs. Our emotional life may even become worse before it gets better. Uncovering hidden or suppressed wounds is uncomfortable and can trigger unexpected emotional reactions. Healing is highly likely to be our first priority after years of denying or ignoring inner pain. In the long run, we can only benefit from the internal spring cleaning of any mess that blocks our joy in living. In the widely read book, After the Ecstasy, The Laundry, Jack Kornfield, who has practiced and taught Buddhism for decades, writes, "For almost everyone who practices, times of profound peace and newfound love are often overtaken by periods of loss, by closing up, fear, or the discovery of betrayal, only to be followed again by equanimity or joy. A spiritual path does not provide an escape from the suffering in life and may even rub our noses in it. Yet over time, we are sure to note progress in all areas of our life as our minds become healthier places." So in closing, since meditation is so powerful, why not throw our energies into this and forget the Buddhist part? People everywhere are making a commitment to meditation for the sake of their health, stress management, or to help them achieve their goals. But this raises the question, what kind of world do I want to live in? One where everyone pursues self-improvement and tries to make the world more comfortable for number one? Or would I prefer a world of interconnected beings who care about each other, serve their communities, and love and help each other? One way to address the isolation and lack of community in modern life is to favour an orientation which considers more than ourselves and our limited world. Rather than foster a culture of meditators who can only achieve higher states of consciousness, heal themselves, and achieve their worldly goals, I want to be part of a movement that enables us to reconnect with each other as well. One that recognises the preciousness and vulnerability of human beings. In Buddhism, compassion for others is the way to connect to the divine. Words will never capture the enormity of the truth that we all overlook. They can provide a hint, but will always be inadequate to describe the potential of what we can experience and who we can be. Buddhism teaches that with love, we can be so much more than a body made up of its five senses and its rational mind, that we have a great deal more potential than we realise. Always acknowledging the suffering and imperfection of our lives, Buddhist practice gives us pause for hope. Doubtless, it is this that makes Buddhism such a fast-growing and popular practice. So there we go. That is Buddhism for Mothers. I hope that you have really enjoyed it, and I hope that you got a lot out of that chapter, because I think it really wraps up how powerful the whole art of Buddhism is and the art of conscious parenting, I think. Now, at the end of this book, there is actually an appendix of the Noble Eightfold Path. Now, I'm not going to be reading that, but if you do want to get access to that, I'm actually going to type it out, and it's going to be included in the Inner Circle. So if you go to subconsciousuccess.com/innercircle, you'll get all of the summaries and notes for all of the books that I do, or at least the ones that have access to it. And you'll also get like some free courses and a whole heap of other stuff that I am going to put in there for my Subconscious Success family. So thanks so much for joining me with this book, and I really loved bringing it to you. Make sure you check out my other books. I've got Eckhart Tolle's Power of Now, Eckhart Tolle's A New Earth. I've also got the Napoleon Hill book, Grow Rich with Peace of Mind. And I'm going to be reading next Dr. Joe Dispenza's book, Breaking the Habit of Being Yourself. So lots and lots coming up. Make sure you head across to Superconscious Success Podcast. I'm going to be doing a lot more interviews coming up. I'm going to be doing a lot more solo episodes. Check out Your Spiritual Shift. We all, Carl and I also have a podcast with that. And we are creating a program at the moment, which is launching 1st of October. And it's going to be based on A Course in Miracles. That is going to be fantastic. If you really want to delve into your spirituality, delve into eliminating that ego and moving past that, then this is the one that you want to check out. And on top of that, I've got my Peace and Prosperity program with my good friend Christopher Salem. And we're also going to be launching that on the 1st of October. That is about really connecting peace and harmony with that of prosperity and bringing more wealth and abundance into your life while harmonizing with the eight pillars of wellness. So thanks so much. Check those two out. I look forward to bringing you the next book, and make sure you check out the other ones too. Okay, thanks a lot. Catch you later. Bye.